This morning we continue our study of the man who we know of as the Apostle Paul. And yet there's a lot to know about him before he became an apostle. We noticed last week what we can know about his upbringing. He was born, apparently, in the city of Tarsus, which was in the province of Cilicia, which was on the northeast coast of the Mediterranean Sea. The province of Cilicia was a wealthy province, and the capital of that province and the center of its industry and trade was the city of Tarsus, a city of over 500,000 people in New Testament times. It was located at several crossroads, trading route that came from the east, from the ancient Persian Empire, passed over the Taurus Mountains off to their east, and then passed through or came to Tarsus. There was another passage through the mountains to the north of them called the Cilician Gates, which gave them access to the interior of what is today Turkey, in their time called Galatia. And a lot of trade passed back and forth from Galatia through those Cilician Gates into Tarsus. And from there, not only would it go out by other trade routes, but a very significant part was that a river ran through Tarsus that came out of the Taurus Mountains, came down through Tarsus, and on down to the Mediterranean Sea, only about 10 miles away. And the river was deep enough and wide enough that ships literally could sail out of the Mediterranean and up the Cydnus River to the docks that were at Tarsus. And so they had this perfect, almost, opportunity to be a center of great trade. On top of that, it was a great educational center. It had a number of ancient universities there. At one time, in history at least, it was considered a greater place to go and get your education than even Alexandria or Athens would be. And it's in this city that a Jewish boy is born, and on the eighth day was circumcised, and was named by his father Saul, because they were not only Jewish, they were of the tribe of Benjamin. And the most famous person in Jewish history from the tribe of Benjamin was the first king of Israel by the name of Saul. And this man names his son after that great ancient king. So he grows up Jewish. He learns his father's trade. Later we know that Paul was, as it says, a tent maker. That's really doesn't translate quite to the way we would think today, so much that he made tents, but rather he made the material, the cloth from which the tents were made. He was a cloth maker. In Cilicia, they had a kind of goat that produced long black hair, and that hair could be woven into a heavy, durable, almost weatherproof material from which tents and soldiers' outer cloaks could be made. And so it was much in demand by the not only the Roman government for tents, but even for the clothing, outer clothing from their soldiers when they had to fight or be encamped in winter weather. And it was a very portable kind of trade because it didn't take a lot of equipment in their day and time to weave this cloth. If you could just have a source of supply and a little place to set up. And so everywhere Paul went, when it was necessary, he would be engaged again into this cloth-making business to help support himself and others. Sons almost always learn their trade from their fathers. So it's altogether likely, I think very probable, that not only was his father a cloth-maker, but actually ran a very successful business. All the indications are that Paul's family, as we call him Paul, Saul at that time, that Saul's family was a well-to-do, maybe even wealthy family. And that gave him some privileges because of that wealth that maybe some other Jewish boys growing up outside of the Holy Land might not have. His father probably was able to go, if not every year, at least regularly, to one of the great feasts down in Jerusalem. That was quite a long-distance travel. He would take his son with him. And they would, in one of those three great feasts that all Jewish men were asked to be at every year, would get to see the holy city, actually be there for those great ceremonies, and confirm and reaffirm their faith. Paul would grow up attending a synagogue in Tarsus. He would be taught, starting at the age of 5, to memorize the Scriptures. By the age of 12, he would complete what would amount to a confirmation. And at age 13, he would be officially inducted into the congregation of Israel as a male member of the Jewish family. He held 3 citizenships. He spoke 3 languages. He not only knew intimately the teachings and faith of the Jews, but he also understood and knew a great deal of the teachings and the philosophy and so forth of the world around him because of where he grew up. He was a citizen of Tarsus. In that time, it was very important that you actually had a citizenship in the town where you live. Usually, citizenship was only attached to those who owned property and who exceeded a certain level financially in the community. You weren't lower class. You probably weren't even middle class. You had to be pretty much upper class to be a citizen of a city. He was a city. He was a citizen of the city of Tarsus, it says. He said that himself. He was a citizen of the Jewish nation. Even though he didn't live in Judea, because of his complete dedication to the Jewish religion, he was a Jew by citizenship. But he also held Roman citizenship. We don't know exactly how he came by that. He used it on more than one occasion to demand his rights when he was being mistreated, and it would advance the cause of Christ by doing so. He was born a Roman citizen, which would mean that his father and perhaps even his grandfather before him also held Roman citizenship. This was the most valuable and rare of the 3 citizenships he held. We don't know how he came by that. Perhaps his father or grandfather had done something on behalf of the Roman government that they granted it. Roman citizenship to those who were not born in the city of Rome or in the nation that made up Italy, Roman citizenship was not just granted arbitrarily. The emperor himself had to give it. And Paul's family had it, and it passed on from generation to generation. And as we say all these things about him, think for a moment how different this makes Saul from the other disciples of Jesus, the other 12, the 11 that he initially recruited and was with him. Judas is killed. He's replaced by another man just as qualified by the name of Matthias. All 12 of them were born and raised, and all of their lives had been spent in the land of Galilee or in Judea. They had known Jesus not only from the beginning of his ministry, at least some of them apparently had known him all their life. Some of them perhaps were even relatives of his, cousins. How different Saul is. Most of them would only speak one language well, the Aramaic of their land. They would have some working knowledge, but not be very proficient in Greek, because that was the language of commerce, of international commerce. Paul could speak Greek fluently, he could speak Aramaic fluently, and he had at least a working knowledge of the Latin language, which was the language of Rome. And while they were rural, small town, lower to maybe middle class people in terms of their social standing where they grew up, he would be of the upper class from a huge urban area and be very comfortable going in and out among people who were not Jewish. And that's in spite of the fact that he would dress differently, look differently, and talk differently than the people around him, because he was a devoted Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Pharisee, it says. And as we think about this man and what he is to become, first of all, he's to become a persecutor of Christianity, and then he's to become a disciple of Jesus. Brought with me this morning one of many books I have on the Apostle Paul. This one is called Paul. It's written by a man by the name of Gene Getz. And then at the very first paragraph of the very first chapter of his book, this is what he says. He says, "I have never met anyone whose sincerity prior to his conversion has outdistanced Paul's. But neither have I met anyone who was so woefully mistaken and misguided. Many people who make bad decisions and choices have wrong motives. They know they're wrong. Not so with Paul. He acted, as he says, in ignorance and unbelief." In 1 Timothy 1:13, "With all his heart, he thought he was right. which is one of the greatest lessons all of us can learn from Paul's life. It's possible to be very earnest and fervent in our beliefs and behavior, but dead wrong. Paul was earnest and fervent in his Jewish faith. He was fully committed to what it was all about. And we look today at that part of his life, not of his growing up, but of that part where he becomes a persecutor of Christianity. Being devoted to the Jewish faith means that his parents and his family had followed the teaching of Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 6. If we turn back there, this is something that every Jewish parent knew. It says there, "Hear, O Israel." Now this is the great pronouncement that every Jewish family began and every Jewish man began their prayers with. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." Probably at least from the time he was 12 years old until he became a Christian, every day this man Saul would wake up first thing in the morning. And the first thing he would do when he would get out of bed, would he would reach over and get a special leather strap that he would start by wrapping around his hand and then around his arm. It was called a phylactery. And on this phylactery, on the back of his hand, would be a small leather pouch. And inside that pouch would be a little strip of parchment. And written on that piece of parchment would be Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 6. And he would wear that all day, every day. Then after he had wrapped that around his arm, he would reach and get another strap that had another little box or pouch on it. And he would tie that around his forehead, and he would wear it all day long. And inside that little pouch on his forehead, another scripture. And the house he grew up in, right by the front door, on the outside, would be a little opening cut in the wall. And inside of that little opening would be a little chest. And inside of that little chest would be scripture. And every day before, when they would walk into their house, they would put their hand on that opening before they walked in the house. And the last thing they would do as they would walk out of their house every day is they'd put their hand up there. It was their way of committing themselves, as God said, quite literally, there in Deuteronomy chapter 6, to binding His word on their arms and on their foreheads and having that at the entrance to their houses. Like I said, he would be different than other people who lived in Tarsus, except other Jews, even though he was fully conversant and able to work within that environment among Gentiles, and yet he was Jewish. Sometimes we see on television today some of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish people in Jerusalem, or even maybe in New York City. If you've ever been to a large urban center that has a ultra-Orthodox Jewish population, you recognize them right away, don't you? Black suits, black hats, long sideburns down either side. The men have full beards. And yet, they're in business. They own electronic stores. They own clothing stores. They own other kinds of businesses. They're merchants in the cities where they live, even though they're different. That's how Paul would have been. Apparently, he excelled at his studies in the Jewish law and traditions, so much so that his family was able to afford to send him to Jerusalem. Now, this would have happened about the time he was 15 years old, because that would be typically when they would do that. And Paul himself says in his own writings that he had been instructed by a famous Jewish teacher by the name of Gamaliel. In Acts chapter 22, Paul is speaking to a crowd. He's been up at the temple, and there's been a riot. They almost beat him to death, and he's been rescued by the Roman soldiers. But the Roman commander gives him permission to speak to the crowd. And it says in Acts 22 and verse 2, "When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Then Paul said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers and was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. Paul says he had been taught, trained by Gamaliel. That may not mean a lot to us, but let me tell you what it means to any Jewish person who's religious even today. The Jewish people in all of their history list only seven men as they consider the great scholars of the Jewish faith. Gamaliel is one of them. In all their history, from the time of Moses to today, they only list seven men as their great scholars, and Gamaliel is one of them. Gamaliel was actually the grandson of a man who was a great teacher in his own right by the name of Hillel. He died in about A.D. 20. This would be, you know, during the New Testament period of time, while Jesus was growing up, while Paul was growing up. Hillel was actually, for quite a number of years, the president of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is a ruling council of the Jews. It met, and most of the men who were part of it lived in or right around Jerusalem. Hillel was the president of the Sanhedrin. The vice president of the Sanhedrin during this same period of time was a man by the name of Shammai. And these two men, great Jewish scholars in their own right, had very different views about Jewish faith and the Jewish scriptures in some ways. Some of the writings that have even come down to us today from the Jews of this period of time are records of the debates of these two men with each other that they held in public. Shammai held a very literal, strict, even austere view of the scriptures, and he interpreted them very literally to the extent that he would override things having to do with grace or mercy, or some people even said common sense, to literally fulfill what the scriptures said. So for example, when Jesus referred to the Jews tithing even the mint and anise and cumin that grew in the corners of their gardens, that would be the kind of teaching Shammai would have made. Literally applying it that way. Hillel, on the other hand, was a man, while very much a student of the scriptures and taught a great deal about the scriptures, was considered a more gentle, merciful person and would often teach his students that they should temper their understanding of the scripture with the fact that God is a loving God. But he also did something else, which we very much see happening in New Testament times. He taught that tradition was just as important as law. And that sometimes, if we don't understand exactly what the law means, then follow the tradition. And don't we see that happening in the New Testament among the Pharisees? They had these traditions that they practiced. And here's this young man, Saul, who is sent by his family to go be enrolled in the school of Gamaliel in Jerusalem. And typically that time of training would be 4 to 5 years, from what we know of other Jewish records from that time. And he would imbibe of this spirit and this teaching and this thinking of Gamaliel, this great grandson, this great grandson. He's not great grandson, he's a great descendant of Hillel and a grandson named Gamaliel. Gamaliel also becomes a president of the Senate or the Sanhedrin that the Jewish people had, and served in that capacity for 35 or 40 years. And Paul had been instructed by him. The interesting thing is that later in life, like in Acts chapter 22, when we see the Apostle Paul being arrested there, he'll actually end up appearing before the Sanhedrin. This was at the time in Jewish history shortly after Gamaliel had died and been replaced by another president of the Sanhedrin. Gamaliel died just a few years before Paul is back in Jerusalem and stands trial there. Just a little note from our history of what we know. But what was the good of Paul growing up in this Jewish faith and being taught by a man like Gamaliel? First of all, he would have known the Jewish scriptures intimately. He would have memorized a great portion of them. He could quote them freely. In fact, we see that in the writings of Paul later. He will quote from the scriptures. He will refer to the scriptures. He will draw conclusions from the scriptures. It's the kind of thing that a person trained and taught by someone like Gamaliel would be able to do. And it made him different than what Peter or John or Matthew or Mark would be able to do. Not that they couldn't, by the Holy Spirit, write inspired things, but just their whole thought process would be very different because they didn't have that kind of training like Paul did. It also means that he believed there was only one God, and that God has a plan for this universe, and that the Scriptures are His holy writings. He believed in the coming of the Messiah. He believed that God was at work in all things. He believed that the Jews were God's chosen people, and that one day God was going to send this Messiah to reign over His world. He would be willing to live and die for His faith. He would not have compromised it. The Sadducees tended to be compromisers. The Pharisees were not. Their faith and their practices were non-negotiable. Paul was of that group. His zealousness would reach to the point of fanaticism. At the age of 19 or 20, when he had finished his initial studies with Gamaliel, it seems like, from what we have in the Scriptures, that he probably returned to Tarsus. Now, why is that important? That would mean that he would probably return to Tarsus and probably return to his father's business, but he also would have become a rabbi in one of the synagogues in Tarsus. That's why Gamaliel trained these young men, is so they could go out to wherever they came from and teach the next generation God's law. So he would have been a rabbi or sort of a perhaps a rabbi in waiting in Tarsus, even as he worked at this trade. But that would also be the exact time that Jesus' public ministry began. And for 3.5 years, he did the things we read about in the Gospels. And eventually, as he goes to Jerusalem, he would be arrested. There would be the trial. There'd be the crucifixion. There'd be the resurrection. And then there would be the ascension. And there would be Pentecost. And because Paul never mentions in his writings that he was present during any of those things, it seems reasonable to believe he was in Tarsus all that time, practicing his Jewish faith, and maybe only hearing with some alarm what's going on back in the city he's just left a few years before. But then he returns. We don't know what the prompting is for his return to Jerusalem, but we know after the day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2, the preaching of the gospel there, the church begins. By Acts chapter 7, there he is. He's come back. Is it because he wanted to see what he could do to help stop this new faith that's springing up? We don't know. But there he is. And so the bad of this great Jewish education and faith that Paul had is it had turned him, like most of the others who were Pharisees, into legalistic believers. That is, they believed that their salvation and their relationship with God was based solely upon their performance and their accurate keeping of the law and the traditions. That's what Hillel and Gamaliel had both taught, that the traditions were just as important as the law, and so keeping those traditions was what kept you in a right relationship with God. Paul will say about that in Philippians chapter 3, as we recognize this passage, he says, "We now put no confidence in the flesh, though I myself have reasons for such confidence. If anyone else thinks he has reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee, as for zeal, persecuting the church, as for legalistic righteousness, faultless." Look at the things he's telling about himself. We've covered most of them already. He was Jewish. He was of that race of people. But more than just the race, he was of that religion. He was circumcised on the eighth day. That's what the law specified for the male children. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. That means he knew what his genealogy was. He wasn't just Jewish generically. He was Jewish specifically. He could trace his family lineage. Not many Jews could make that claim, actually. A Hebrew of Hebrews. That meant that there was no one in his ancestry who was anything but Jewish. If your great-grandmother or your great-great-great-grandfather was Gentile and just converted to the Jewish faith, you couldn't say you were a Hebrew of the Hebrews. Only those who could say that generation after generation, their ancestors had always been Jewish by both faith and by the flesh, by race. In regard to the law, a Pharisee, that means he believed the whole Old Testament was God's law, not just the first five books like the Sadducees believed. So that was a very important distinction there. He says, as for zeal, I persecuted the church, which we will get to. And he says, as for legalistic righteousness, that is keeping all the traditions and the rules and the regulations, he says, I was faultless. This man had been zealous and dedicated to doing everything he had been taught to do in the Jewish faith. That means he kept all the Sabbath traditions, he kept all the dress traditions, all the food traditions, everything he kept. He was devoted to all of that. Now, later, we'll hear him say to the Romans that he found himself eventually in a situation in which he said, I'm in a terrible situation in my life. I can't live perfectly. It was only when he finally came to that realization he could understand something about the forgiveness that God offered in Jesus Christ. That you cannot work your way to salvation. But at this time, at least, he could say, as for legalistic righteousness, I was faultless. He talks about having confidence in the flesh. Literally, that would mean he could actually physically see the mark of being a man of God in his flesh, because he had been circumcised. He could look at his family tree and say, I can put confidence in the flesh because my flesh is all Jewish. But that applied, this confidence in the flesh applied to more than just literally the circumcision and the genealogies. It meant that his term of his flesh, he kept all these rules and regulations and traditions, and he at one time had put great confidence in that. So here's a person who's devoted his life to trying to keep all the traditions, to know all he can about what God wants him as a Jewish person to do. And is well on the way, if he wasn't already, to being a rabbi, teaching others, training others in the law of God. And then here comes someone along claiming to be the Messiah. And while we have no indication that Paul had ever seen him in person during the years he had lived in Jerusalem, nevertheless, this person, Jesus, went against everything that Paul had come to believe in. We'll have the opportunity next week to talk about what would convert Paul. What else could be done to convince Paul to change? At this point in time, he's not changed. It tells us that in Acts chapter 6, that as the church continues to grow, the Sanhedrin has already warned them once about the leaders of the group, about their teaching and so forth. But in Acts chapter 6, a problem arises within the church there in Jerusalem, and that is that some of the Christians who were Grecian, their widows were not being taken care of. And so the apostles calls the church together, and seven men are selected to oversee the care of the Grecian widows in the church. Now, these Grecian widows would have been Jewish women from outside of the Holy Land, who were now back living there, perhaps had retired there after their husbands passed away or something. And the church and its benevolence program needed to pay attention to their needs. And of those seven who are appointed to that responsibility, interestingly, all seven of them have non-Jewish names. The apostles were wise enough, and the church was wise enough, to appoint men who could relate well to these Grecian widows and their needs, by appointing men who themselves were Grecian, but Jewish, but now Christian, to do that. But some of these men went far beyond just being good servants and taking care of the needs of the widows. Two of them, at least, Stephen and Philip, were great preachers. And one of those two, a man by the name of Stephen, it says in Acts 6, verse 8, Stephen, a man full of God's grace and power, did great wonders and miraculous signs among the people. He's actually able to perform miracles. God has empowered him with that. But it says opposition arose from members of the synagogue of the freedmen, and from Jews of Cyrene and Alexandria, as well as the provinces of Cilicia and Asia. In addition to the temple being in Jerusalem, there were quite a number, we don't know how many, synagogues. These were the places where the Jewish families would come on Sabbath to worship God. And they also would usually serve as schools during the week for the children to be taught in. Often these synagogues in a larger city like this, where there were many of them, sort of ended up being different things for different folks. And here's this one synagogue, or maybe two. Scholars say the language is just obscure enough here in the Greek that it may well be talking about two different synagogues. That one was a synagogue of the freedmen, and the other would be the synagogue of people from the provinces of Cilicia and Asia. But whether it's one synagogue or two, it seems like that this Stephen apparently ended up engaging particularly people from these particular synagogues in very public discussions about whether or not Jesus was the Messiah. Now, did you notice that one of the groups represented by this synagogue or these synagogues are people from Cilicia? Tarsus, where Paul was from, is in Cilicia. This would be the synagogue where Paul or Saul attended. And it says that as these discussions are going on, opposition arises. And it says, these men began to argue with Stephen. That would include Saul. He considers himself a scholar. He's considered a scholar by others. He's been trained by Gamaliel. So they're having this discussion with Stephen, and it says, but they could not stand up against his wisdom or the spirit by which he spoke. Stephen set them down. Just like Jesus often set down those who opposed him and tried to argue against him. Stephen is able to do the same thing, not in a bad way, but they can't resist, they can't answer the arguments he's making. So what are they going to do? I'll tell you what a lot of people were doing, they were converting to Christianity. But not these men, not Saul, not the others. So they secretly persuaded some men to say, we have heard Stephen speak words of blasphemy against Moses and God. So rather than being able to answer Stephen's arguments, they then go out and find men, and it says in the text here, actually in the Greek, that they actually suborned men. That is, they persuaded men to commit perjury. Now here's a man that's supposed to be devoted to the law of God. And one of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not lie, or thou shalt not bear false witness. And yet they convince some of their own number to do that very thing. To lie about what they heard Stephen say. Why would they try to persuade these men to lie about what Stephen said? So they can have Stephen arrested and charged with blasphemy. And under Jewish law, that was a crime worthy of death. And one of the people involved in this conspiracy is Saul. We'll stop there for this morning. I found this little quotation. It comes from C.S. Lewis's book called Mere Christianity. If any of you know anything about a man by the name of C.S. Lewis, he was a very prominent philosopher and teacher in England in the first half of the last century. Highly respected, a great instructor in the universities over there, and an agnostic. He argued for years against even whether we could even know if there is a God, much less whether or not Christianity is true. But he later became a Christian and spent the rest of his life arguing forcefully for the truth of Christianity. And one of his books, one of his most popular books, is a book called Mere Christianity. And perhaps he was even speaking of himself, but it certainly would apply to Saul as well. In that book, he says in one place, a proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see something that is above you. Paul, in his pride, in his confidence, in his zeal, in his faith, so focused on what's wrong with these people who are arguing that Jesus was the Messiah, that he can't look up and see what God is doing. We'll continue next week. We have an invitation song. It invites us to think about our faith. And while we want to be as devoted to our faith as Saul was to his, we also want to be right. And if we ever find ourselves starting to have to do things dishonest and dishonorable to defend our faith, it really is time to step back and take another look. Because truth does not need that kind of defense. It doesn't need violence. Doesn't need lies. Doesn't need deception. Truth will stand. But if any of us need to respond in any way to the invitation this morning, we can do that now while we stand up and sing this song.